please.
Good morning, Your Honors. I will try not to be redundant with the earlier cases, which also address the sentencing guidelines. My name is Steve Greenberg. I represented Mr. McIlrath in the lower court, as well as obviously here. And what happened in Mr. McIlrath's case was we submitted extensive documentation to the sentencing court regarding an evaluation. This case involved interstate travel for the purpose of having sex with a minor. We submitted extensive documentation as to Mr. McIlrath's psychological background and personal characteristics, and those were completely ignored by the trial court. The trial court did not comment.
But the problem is that everybody who commits this particular crime is going to have some kind of peculiar personal circumstances, psychiatric problems, personality deficiencies. That's just the nature of the crime. So what is it that makes him different from the other violators?
Well, I can't speak to what the other individuals do at the time of sentencing and what kind of evidence they present, but in our particular sentencing, we presented evidence from a forensic psychologist who, in fact, does a great deal of work for the United States government and some of their agencies as to not only the peculiar harm that Mr. McIlrath would suffer if he were sentenced to the penitentiary.
So you have these people going to these chat rooms looking for minors, and I imagine they all have characteristics similar to McIlrath. It isn't normal behavior, right?
I would agree with that. It is not normal.
Well, don't you have to show that there's something special about him?
Judge, I don't think I have to show that there's something special about him. The problem here is that it's obvious from the sentencing that the judge didn't consider at all what we submitted. He talked about people paying for experts and had a general disdain for high-paid experts, of which this was not a high-paid expert.
Well, he says that at one point, but I'm just looking again at his comments. And he ultimately gets around on page 41 of the transcript, which is Appendix 33. He says, "While I appreciate that Dr. Ostroff and Dr. Lucas may have some views, no one, not even Christopher McIlrath, can predict today with any degree of certainty whether this sort of conduct is going to occur in the future." I mean, maybe it's not as sympathetic a treatment of their opinions as you might have liked, but I read him as saying that he knows this evidence is in there, but it's really just not compelling enough to cause him to think that it outweighs other characteristics of the case.
Well, that may be the case, except for the fact that he says that they may have some views. No one can predict it. So what he's saying is it doesn't matter what these people say at all.
No, he doesn't.
Accepting it.
No, because he says historically there have been individuals like him. He says he hopes that, you know, this won't occur in his case. He understands it's a bitter pill to swallow. You know, at the end of the day, he talks about the good advocacy, both written and oral, on Mr. Greenberg's part, as well as your father. And, I mean, I don't know. I think he makes a very good record in terms of presenting his reasons and why it is. I mean, it seems to me the reason he wasn't as sympathetic is he's talking about the problems that individuals face and the difficulty in trying to make this kind of prediction.
Judge, I can tell you that oftentimes when I lose, it's always prefaced with what good advocacy I did on behalf of my client.
Cold comfort, huh?
So that rarely is any comfort to me. And please don't offer that compliment at the end of this argument. One of the things we framed in our brief was a claim.
Well, that's the first time we've been asked not to be nice.
One of the things that I included in our opening brief, and it wasn't addressed by the Rita court, and I think this is at the core of all of this, is that I think there's an inherent conflict with starting at the guidelines, because the guidelines do not consider the personal characteristics other than criminal history, physical condition, mental condition, and all of these things. And the judge here did not consider all of those things. There was no rebuttable report here. There was no opposition to what was found. We had empirical data, and I can tell you that if we had gone in front of this court on some kind of case where they, with Dr. Ostrov and Dr. Lucas, where they wanted to lock up a sex offender on one of these sexually violent persons cases, the judge would have looked at this and said, oh, this is good data, this is good information. So why just discount it in this case?
Well, but I was interested in that argument of yours. But the fact is, you've got to start somewhere. You're either going to start at the general and then see if you need to qualify it somehow for the specific, or you're going to start with the specific and you're going to have to say, well, is that going to create so many disparities nationwide that we need to move back to the general? And Congress, I think, is, or the Supreme Court, as I read them, and Rita and Booker and all of these, don't have any problem with starting with the general, namely the guidelines, and then putting in this corrective after that's properly been calculated to make sure the specific is okay. That's what Judge Stepmuller does here, and maybe, you know, in your view, overweighs the nature of Mr. McElrath's conduct, et cetera, but the judge seems to have gone through the right procedures.
It's not the procedures. He goes through the procedures that were found to be proper under Booker. But it's the fact, and as the Rita Court said, these things are not addressed in the guidelines. You've got a starting point, but you've got a starting point that doesn't fit every individual. And
which is why you correct after you've gone through that starting point. And he just didn't correct as much as you thought, given the nature of this person's offense. He should have.
Well, I feel he didn't do anything. He makes, well, although he says that people say these things, he doesn't ever give a reason why he's discounting it. He doesn't ever say, this is why I believe this doesn't apply. And I think that at a minimum...
Well, what if he had just said, you know, I know this psychologist has made this prediction, but it's just not a profession that can come up with enough certainty for me and weighed against the nature of the conduct. I think I'm going to stick with the low end of the guideline.
Well, so didn't the psychologist say 9 to 13%?
He said if there was no treatment, which, by the way, now that Mr. McElrath is in an institution, he gets no treatment. But he said if there was no treatment, if there was no other means, monitoring, no electronic monitoring, no monitoring of computers and so forth, it was 9 to 13%. But with treatment and so forth, it could get substantially less.
It's high to me, actually, 9 to 13%.
This was not, you know, as the judge commented, this was not someone we went out and said, who can we pay the most money to give us the most favorable opinion? This was someone who does a lot of work for the government. The problem is where they don't address any of this, and if he did discount it because of his own personal beliefs, if he doesn't articulate those, as someone was saying earlier, how can we respond to that? How can we ask him to reconsider? How can we articulate for him reasoning?
What do you want him to say? I don't understand.
I want him to say something other than a lot of rich people go out.
If you wanted to sentence this person to 46 months, what would you say?
I would explain why I found the psychological evidence not to be compelling.
I would like to see some indication that this person is any more disturbed or any more susceptible of treatment than the average such violator.
And I think it did say that.
Otherwise, you just ratchet down until these people don't get any sentences, even though we have this problem of people using the Internet to prey on teenagers.
I'm not saying that he should be given, you know, a pizza, beer, and sent on his merry way, Judge, but what I'm saying is that there certainly is something other than a guideline sentence that's appropriate. And here we gave the sentencing court a lot of data that was unchallenged by the government. The government just said
you're saying your data went to the question whether he was more likely to succeed at treatment than maybe others.
Yes. If you read the opinion of Dr. Ostrov, which is included.
What's special about him that would make him responsive to treatment?
I think his particular circumstances, that this was a one-time singular event.
What about that earlier business with the 12-year-old?
The other chatting? It was in the same time frame, Judge. It was all included in there.
It's not isolated.
But it's an isolated travel, and based on the testing, I believe that it was, in fact, a one-time event. And based on the fact
Why do you think it's a one-time event?
Well,
something
because I'm relying on the
happened in his life or something.
Yes.
What?
He was 30 years old when he lost his virginity, and the next day his first and only girlfriend dropped him. And this conduct followed soon thereafter. And there was nothing to indicate that. He also has a focus disorder of some type, I can't recall the exact term, where he actually focuses on Ked's shoes and requested in these discussions that the people wear nothing other than white Ked shoes.
I don't see why that is as mitigating.
And
this business with the girlfriend, well, why wouldn't one expect incidents of this rejection to recur in the future?
Because one would expect him to get treatment, which is, in fact, it's a psychological crime.
Is there any evidence of this? Is there any empirical evidence that treatment of these people has an effect?
I believe there is, and in fact, the judge himself ordered treatment when he finished his sentence in the Department of Corrections, so he must believe it.
My question is there empirical evidence that this kind of treatment, whatever it is, psychiatric treatment, has any effect?
Yes.
What is that?
I can't cite you the studies, but they're the same studies that were cited.
There's a long history of people who thought you could change people from homosexual into heterosexual by psychiatry. Yeah, long history of that.
I'm not touching that.
It's an example of how psychiatrists often exaggerate the efficacy of their methods.
They may, but there is a whole industry of that the Supreme Court has found in Kansas versus Hendricks and other cases, in fact, is valid and not voodoo science. They have found that if you incarcerate these people in these sexually violent centers after they finish their term of imprisonment, that at some point they can be restored. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why they find that conduct is proper and that you can incarcerate these people. So if the Supreme Court has found that, I'm not going to argue with that. And I don't think we can say, well, when we want to punish someone, it's voodoo science. But when we want to lock them up, it's good science. I see my red lights.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Greenberg. Mr. Koenig?
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Jonathan Koenig, and I appear on behalf of the United States. According to the defendant, at least in his opening brief, the district judge never touched on the 3553A factors, never discussed his psyche or his life, and completely ignored the report of the forensic psychiatrist. Instead, according to the defendant, the court focused exclusively on the guidelines. If all of this were true, I would agree that this case should be remanded to the district court for resentencing. But with respect, I think the arguments are overstated. And some of this has been covered in the previous questioning relative to the psychiatrist's report. The court may not have laid out a perfectly detailed and extremely well-organized justification or analysis of the 3553A factors.
Well, in fact, the judge was very dismissive of the psychiatrist report. Sort of rich people come in and throw psychiatrist reports at me is the gist of what he said, which was A, fairly dismissive, and B, not particular to Dr. Ostroff. I mean, certainly there are psychiatrists and psychiatrists. I'm sure some of them are hacks and some of them are terrific, you know, committed professionals who are doing the best they can to evaluate. And you don't see any sense of sorting from the judge.
And I would agree that that's unfortunate, Your Honor. However, as you pointed out in your question earlier, the judge did eventually get around to a more particularized discussion of the report in this case. And I think it's significant that that occurred in the context of discussing the need to protect the public. This is on page 41 of the sentencing transcript. He begins by saying protection of the public is an incredibly important factor in a case such as this. And then he talks about the risk of reoffending, the report, and so on. And I think what he's trying to say, and it may be dangerous to venture a guess, but I think what he's trying to communicate here is that any risk is a risk. And this defendant, according to his own expert, was a low to moderate risk. I think in looking at these kinds of questions, courts have to ask sort of a hand formula type question. What is the magnitude of the potential harm here? It's very, very great. It involves our young people. And so that even a low risk can't be dismissed. I think that may be what he was getting at. The judge in this case did what he was required to do under Dean and Rita. He addressed the seriousness of the offense on page 37 of the transcript, the need for deterrence on page 40, the need to protect the public on page 41.
The judge did place some weight, did he not, on the fact of this other seeming attempt to get together with the 12-year-old that I guess never happened, but that other exchange?
I'm not sure if that was specifically addressed by the judge. It was certainly brought to his attention in the context of the sentencing memorandum.
It was in the pre-sentence report?
Yes. In fact, I believe it was included in the factual proffer that was part of the plea agreement. I could be mistaken, but I'm fairly certain about that. So I think when you look at this record, you can see that the district judge assigned greater weight to some factors than others. But it's in the nature of the 3553A factors that he be allowed to do that. The statute doesn't assign any particular weight to those factors. And this court has said in the Beyer case that sentencing judges have enormous latitude in this regard. So for all of the reasons that I've discussed, I would ask that you affirm the sentence of 46 months.